Well, you know, we live in a period of time that is an aberration in history. All we can remember is the world dominated by the Anglo-Saxon powers. In the last 60 years, the United States has dominated the world. Before World War II, it was the British Empire. You'd have to go back 250 years, really, to a world that was dominated by any other power. Before the British, it was the French. Before the French, it was the Spanish. And then you're going way back in time. So really, our view of the world is obviously clouded by the reality that we see, which is a world dominated by the United States. We have certain freedoms here, including the freedom to assemble like this. And other churches, of course, have that freedom too, for which we're very, very thankful. But most of the world still does not have that. And even our ancestors did not have that. But of course, it makes it more difficult to understand history and to understand what the world was like when other nations dominated the world. Because not all nations have been as nice, if I can use that word, as the US and Britain have been. In fact, some nations that have dominated have been very aggressive, very cruel, and very despotic. Another thing that influences our view of history is that we live on average for 70 years, just 70 years, which really isn't very long. So it makes it difficult for us to have an impression of history over the course of 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years. But you know, to God, 1,000 years is as a day. Let me show you a couple of scriptures here. Just have a look at this scripture. It helps us to understand that God looks at things differently to the way we look at things. We can only look at this short period of time, which is our lifespan, and we see a world dominated by the United States. But with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. So to God, 1,000 years is like a day. So what does God see when he looks at history? He doesn't see history the same as we see history. Let's move on to another scripture which helps us understand a fundamental biblical principle regarding history. And that's found in the book of Daniel, which is one of the major prophetic books of the Bible. Daniel reveals a great deal to us. And the most important verse in the book of Daniel is this one in chapter 2 and verse 21. That says this about God. He removes kings and raises up kings. God is in charge, in other words. Romans 8, verse 28 says, all things work together for good. And ultimately, they do, because ultimately, the kingdom of God will be established on the earth, and it will exist forever and ever. But right now, of course, the kingdom of God is not here. But we need to realize God removes kings and raises up kings. He is behind the rise and fall of nations. And what we see in the book of Daniel is a prophecy regarding the rise and fall of nations that covers over 2,600 years. So we're going to cover those 2,600 years in the next 45 minutes, which works out at about 100 years per minute. So we've got to go really fast here, okay. But here is Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7 is the chapter that we're going to concentrate on. And in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 3, we read that four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Now this is a vision that was revealed to Daniel. The meaning was revealed to Daniel. And Daniel was there, a captive in Babylon. He was taken as a teenager from Judah, when Judah was conquered by Babylon. He was taken to Babylon, and there in Babylon he spent most of the rest of his life. But when the Babylonian Empire fell, he actually lived in the Persian Empire as well. So he lived in three different countries, Judah, and then Babylon, and then Persia. He lived under two kings of Babylon, two of Persia, and before that, kings of Judah. And, you know, Daniel was living as a Jew in a nation that was a Gentile nation. And here we see a prophecy relating to the Gentile nations. Four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Now these beasts are symbolic of very big, powerful Gentile empires, superpowers if you like, the superpowers of their day, just as we are a superpower today, so there have been other superpowers in history. And these were four great beasts. They were unlike the United States in that they were aggressive, despotic, tyrannical. You know, they weren't democracies. People did not have rights. Let's continue reading here. Daniel chapter 7, again, in verses 17 and 18. Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Now, what does that tell us? Well, in this particular chapter, four great beasts were prophesied to dominate the earth. And they were to take us right down to the second coming of Jesus Christ when the kingdom is established. Now, the kingdom has not been established at this point. Jesus Christ has not returned. The saints do not possess the kingdom. So, therefore, we are somewhere in this time frame in Daniel chapter 7. And yet right now the world is dominated by the United States, which is not one of these beasts. So therefore we need to piece this together. And the Bible does reveal a great deal to us. Of course, it would be nice if we had a lot more time, but we'll cover as much as we can in this period of time. So let's understand that Daniel 7 covers the period from the time of Daniel, 2,600 years ago, right up until the second coming of Jesus Christ. So here is the first king or kingdom then. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. You know, a lion is a very strong animal, the king of the beasts. And the strength of the lion, it's in its head. When a lion kills, it kills with its head. It just tears the flesh and just kills somebody. I watched till its wings were plucked off and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. This kingdom here is the kingdom of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. This is the Babylonian empire. You will see that it encompasses a vast area. It includes the country of Iraq, where we are involved at this present time. Now, you know, what is interesting is that Saddam Hussein, for example, wanted to recreate the Babylonian empire. So, you know, this is not just ancient history. As one of our previous speakers pointed out, that we in the United States don't tend to think too much about history. But that is not the case elsewhere in the world. You think about it a great deal. In some countries, you know, people trace their ancestry back 1,000 or 1,500 years. It's a big thing to them. The Babylonian Empire, then, is very much a reality in many people's minds even today. But this is the first of the beasts that was prophesied. And you'll notice from the dates there that it lasted in this form for about 70 years. Now here, again, Daniel chapter 7 and verse 5, reading along. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. A bear is different to a lion. A bear is a big, clumsy animal. But if you come into contact with a bear, your chances of survival are not that great. It can do a lot of damage. Today, a bear is used to symbolize the Russians, who are also rather big and clumsy as a nation. But here, it's used to symbolize Persia. And the Persian Empire destroyed the Babylonian Empire. And there's the Persian Empire, slightly different territory, but also at the same time, including, amongst other areas, the Holy Land. You know, these empires all impacted the people of God. They impacted the physical Israelites in the Old Testament, in ancient Israel. They also impacted the spiritual Israelites, the New Testament church, after Jesus Christ came and the church began. So God's people, both physical and spiritual, were affected by these empires. And that's why these empires are in these prophecies. The Chinese empire is not mentioned, the Japanese empire is not mentioned, nor are empires in the Incas or the Aztecs, because they were not relevant to the main storyline, and they had no impact upon God's people. So for after the Persian Empire, the next one we read about is in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 6. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. This is the next empire, the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, who was like a leopard. A leopard moves really fast. And you know, you read accounts of Alexander the Great's conquests. His armies moved so fast, it seemed as if their feet did not touch the ground. Alexander means conqueror of men. And Alexander conquered more territory in the shortest period of time than anybody in history, right up until Hitler in 1940. And you think, by 1940, over 2,000 years later, Hitler had all this technology, tanks and planes, which Alexander never had. So he was an incredible military leader. But then Alexander, just as the prophecy said, died when he was young, and his empire was divided amongst his four generals, the four heads that we saw there. The beast had four heads. Dominion was given to it. Now remember, these words were written in the middle of the 6th century BC. Alexander the Great did not come along until more than 2 centuries later. Josephus, the Jewish historian of the 1st century, describes how when Alexander arrived in Jerusalem, the high priest greeted him and said, "We are expecting you." And he asked why, and the high priest said, "Because the prophet Daniel told us you would come over 200 years before." It's as if George Washington had predicted that George Bush would be the president 225 years later. So this is a significant prophecy that was fulfilled. So this is the Greek Empire. Now we look at the next empire in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. We're still in Daniel 7. "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I want to read to you a comment from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary on the Bible regarding this particular empire, which is the Roman Empire. "Whereas the three former kingdoms were designated respectively as a lion, bear, and leopard, no particular beast is specified as the image of the fourth. For Rome is so terrible as to be not describable by any one, but combines in itself all that we can imagine, inexpressibly fierce in all beasts." So it was the most violent, the most aggressive, the most despotic, the most tyrannical one, and it also lasted the longest. And it had 10 horns. This is the Roman Empire. You see the extent of it. Right over in the east, it conquered the Holy Land and Egypt, and then right across Europe. It even conquered England for a few hundred years. So it was a very big empire, the Roman Empire. And it had 10 horns. Now we have to come to these horns. A horn is symbolic of royal power. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be a king to fulfill a prophecy regarding a horn. I mean, a president would be the equivalent. So, you know, it could be just any leader. But throughout history, most leaders have been kings, not presidents. Daniel 7, verse 8, "I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words." We need to move further down the chapter to understand exactly what or who this is talking about, okay? So this is a little horn that comes up after three of the 10 horns. There are 10 horns. That's 10 revivals of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was to continue in one form or another right down until the second coming of Jesus Christ, okay? And so 10 revivals of the Roman Empire, 10 horns. After the first three, this little horn came up. The first three were plucked out by the roots. In other words, they didn't last very long. They didn't accomplish much. They didn't build any great architecture like the Romans had done. They didn't have any great administration. They put down no roots. They were only there in Rome basically to ransack the place and take what they could. But in order for us to understand what is happening here and to understand this prophecy, we must understand who or what this little horn is talking about. So let's go down to verses 19 and 20 and see it explained more clearly. "Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up, before whom 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes, and a mouth that spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. You see, notice this isn't a military force, this other horn that comes up. It is rather a horn, royal symbol again, with eyes and a mouth that spoke pompous words, pompous exalting the self, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. So, you know, who would have been greater than the leaders of the Roman Empire? Here it's talking about a spiritual authority, a spiritual force. You know, a spiritual force is not a military force. From the mouth comes the words, a mouth that spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. Let's have a look at this again here. In Daniel 7, verse 21 and 22 now, so we're just moving to the next couple of verses. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints, and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So again, you see, this prophecy takes us right up until the second coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. So again, we're still in this period. We're in this time frame here in Daniel chapter 7. It says this horn, the one, the mouth speaking pompous words, and the eyes like the eyes of a man, was making war against the saints. The saints are the true followers of God. So this is a false religious system that was making war against the true followers of God. And when you look at history, you can see exactly who this is talking about. Again, let's just move on here. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue 3 kings. Again, those 3 kings that are plucked up by the roots. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Again, this prophecy about this spiritual authority, you see, and the only spiritual authority that it can be talking about here, the little horn that comes up at this particular time, is the papacy. Again, look at history as God would look at history. You're looking here in Daniel 7 at 2,600 years of history. What has been the dominant force in the Western world that has affected the physical people of Israel and also spiritual Israel, the true church of God? What has affected the people of God more than any others in this last 2,600 years? And the force that that has dominated the world in this time has been the Catholic Church, the papacy. If any of you have an opportunity, you might want to watch a PBS documentary series on the Medici, which brings out that the church was the most powerful institution in history, the most powerful institution in the world. It is the only institution which has existed for 2,000 years. We have this 2,600-year spectrum here, and this force has lasted for 2,000 years. Now, Paul Johnson, who's a historian, wrote a book called The Offshore Islanders, in which he shows this very well. He explains clearly how, when the Roman Empire fell apart, the church simply took over. In Revelation chapter 13, verse 15, the church is described as the image of the beast. The Roman Empire was the beast. It was the fourth beast. And the church was the image of the beast. Now, when you look in the mirror, you see your image. It's not really you, but it looks like you. And the church was similar in its relationship to the Roman Empire. The language of the church was Latin. It still is Latin. The same as the Roman Empire used Latin. Even the colors of the robes that the cardinals and the archbishops, etc., wore were the old imperial colors of the Roman Empire. So the system simply continued in the church, and the church has continued down through the centuries to this time. Now, somebody asked me during one of the breaks why it is that so many Protestant churches do not look at some of these prophecies. And, of course, I think one reason for that is because today, you know, political correctness demands that, you know, we recognize all religions as basically being the same. But our ancestors did not feel that way. If you look at Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary, or you look at Unger's Bible Dictionary, for example, it's very graphic about the role of the papacy throughout history and how it fulfills this particular prophecy. But today we can't really speak about these things. Well, I can, but I guess a lot of people can't. But anyway, that's who it's talking about. And you see, the three little horns that were plucked up by the roots were plucked up before the church became powerful. The three horns plucked up by the roots were the Vandals, who sacked Rome in 455 AD, Odoacer, who took over Rome after the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 AD. He was the first barbarian king of Italy. The Romans considered all foreigners barbarians, so he was a barbarian that came in and took over Rome. And then the Ostrogoths succeeded Odoacer. So we had these three little horns that were plucked up by the roots. But then there were to come seven other revivals of the Roman Empire. So let's have a look at those. Revelation 17, verse 9 here. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Now, a woman in biblical terminology symbolizes the church. You know, in Ephesians chapter 5, the true church is likened to a virgin bride who's going to marry Jesus Christ, who is the bridegroom. Well, the false church is pictured as a harlot, a woman, in other words, who will sell herself for gain, for financial gain or for gain in other areas. The seven heads, these are the seven revivals of the Roman Empire after the woman comes up, after this little horn became powerful, you know, after that point when the church became powerful. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. A mountain is a great empire. A head is the crown, the king or the leader of it, okay? So there were to be seven more revivals of the Roman Empire throughout history in which the church was to be involved. Now, Revelation 17 has something else to say, which I don't have on the screen there. So let me just turn to my Bible and read it. If you have a Bible, you might want to turn there too. But Revelation 17 helps us understand something else here about this religious system. It says, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." A church that has universal power, or Catholic power. Universal and Catholic are the same term. "With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." Okay, what does it mean, the kings of the earth committed fornication? Well, fornication is an uneasy relationship. You know, in marriage, a couple are giving to each other in love. When a couple fornicate, each is trying to get something from the other. So the relationship is never an easy one, and usually is only temporary. And that's the way it's been with the church and the state throughout history. You look at European history, you know, the church, the papacy considered itself over all the kings. So that was the official teaching of the church, that the church was over all the kings. The kings didn't always see it that way. So you had this struggle throughout history, and sometimes the church and the state would come together and work together to try to accomplish something, but it wouldn't last very long. So we see this turmoil in European history, which of course is one reason why when the United States was formed, it was decided there should be a separation of church and state so that this problem that had plagued Europe for hundreds of years would not happen over here. The seven heads then are seven mountains on which the woman sits. So we're looking here for seven revivals of the Roman Empire throughout history. Remember, the Roman Empire was to continue in some form right down until the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, at this present time, the Roman Empire doesn't exist. And there have been other periods where it didn't exist. But the Roman system, which was inherited from the Roman Empire, has continued on down for the last 15 or 16 centuries. So here is the first revival of the Roman Empire. After the fall of the Western Empire, which was ruled from Rome, the Eastern Empire, which is colored there in a kind of a light brown color, the Eastern Empire continued right up until 1453. So it continued for another 1,000 years after the Western Empire collapsed. And the emperor in the East, in the middle of the 6th century AD, wanted to try to revive the empire of the West. So he sent his forces out, and with the Pope's blessing and with the involvement of the church, they tried to revive the Western Empire, and all that purple area was conquered by the Emperor Justinian. But it didn't last. After he died, it kind of fizzled out. The next attempt to revive the Roman Empire was around 800 AD, under the Emperor Charlemagne. Charlemagne, Charles the Great, was crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day in 800 AD. And he ruled over that territory there, Charlemagne's empire. Now, some of you may feel that this is all ancient history, and a lot of people get bored with ancient history. Let me tell you that Charlemagne today is a very great threat to the United States at this time. If any of you read The Economist magazine, you'll know that at the end of their European section, until recently, I think they've stopped it now, but for years, they had a page called Charlemagne. And every issue, this article, every week, was about attempts to unite Europe in the spirit of Charlemagne. Charlemagne's desire was to create one united Catholic Europe. And he succeeded in conquering all that territory that you see there and was quite a powerful monarch. Today, Charlemagne is the inspiration for the European Union, which is again pledged to creating a united Europe. And the United States of Europe, or the European Union, as they call it, threatens American trade, American jobs. I read recently in the Wall Street Journal that 90% of all the business legislation that comes out of Washington is dictated by Europe. We have to comply with their rules simply because they are a bigger trading power than we are. We are a bigger military power, but they are a bigger trading power. So this is Charlemagne's empire, 800 AD. Every year, by the way, the people of the city of Arkham, where Charlemagne came from, where he ruled from, awards the Charlemagne Prize to the person who has done the most to bring about the unification of Europe in the last 12 months. The last recipient last year was Pope John Paul II, which again shows that connection with the church. The recipient 2 or 3 years ago was Bill Clinton. Here is the next attempt. Now, Charlemagne was crowned as the Holy Roman Emperor. But by the time his grandkids came to power, they were falling out amongst themselves, so it kind of fell apart. So about 160 years later, or 150 years after his death, Otto the Great tried to resurrect the Holy Roman Empire. And the Holy Roman Empire, that purple area in the middle there, it wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire. But they called it the Holy Roman Empire. The church taught that it was the kingdom of God on earth. It was the physical kingdom. And, you know, the church was the spiritual kingdom. The Pope was the vicar of Christ. You know, the vicar meaning in place of. Remember the prophecy, a man speaking pompous words. You know, the Pope believes he is Christ's representative on earth, that he is Jesus Christ on earth. And what he says comes from Jesus Christ. It is ex cathedra, meaning it comes from God. And so between the church and the state, everybody was kept under control. The church taught that the people must do what the king says, because the king is appointed by God. The king said you must do what the church says, because the Pope is the vicar of Christ. So everybody was kept under control. And that's how Europe operated right up until the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. So for well over 1,000 years, it was like this. The Holy Roman Empire lasted 1,000 years. The Germans call this the First Reich, or Empire. Remember, Hitler tried to start the Third Reich, which was to last 1,000 years. It didn't. But this was the First Reich, the Holy Roman Empire. It began with Charlemagne in 800, and it lasted to 1806. Again, you look at history from God's perspective and not from our 70 years perspective. What power has been dominant in Western civilization for the past 2,000 years? It's been the Roman system, you see? The Roman Empire and then the Holy Roman Empire. That's another resurrection here at the Roman Empire. Now, the Holy Roman Empire, you know, was somewhat dysfunctional. Sometimes it was quite strong, sometimes it wasn't. Now, most of the time it wasn't. But in the 1500s, another emperor came along who again had a dream of a universal Catholic empire. Now, when Christopher Columbus had discovered the New World, the Pope divided the world between Spain and Portugal, the two greatest maritime powers at the time. Everything to the east of a certain line belonged to Portugal, everything to the west to Spain, which is the reason why even today, Brazil speaks Portuguese, the rest of South America speaks Spanish. And the United States, which wasn't called the United States back then, was given to Spain. And this emperor, Charles V, actually had in his territory Arizona. This was a part of his empire, the southwestern part of what we today call the United States. Now, if it hadn't been for the Protestant Reformation, this country would be completely different. In fact, it wouldn't exist because, you know, we would have been a part of that Spanish Catholic Empire and would have remained a part of Mexico once Mexico broke away from it. But this was the empire of Charles V. He was the Emperor of Austria, ruling from Vienna. He was also the Holy Roman Emperor. Additionally, he was the King of Spain. Spain ruled the Netherlands or Holland, and Spain also ruled Portugal. And Spain possessed all of South America and a large part of North America as well. So this was an incredible empire. And Charles V had the misfortune to become emperor just after Martin Luther nailed his demands to the church door. And so the Protestant Reformation had begun. And Charles V tried to reconcile the Lutherans with the Catholics, but he failed. And the Protestant Reformation, this issue of religion really dominated Europe for the next 200 years. But Charles and his son, Philip II of Spain, tried to establish a universal Catholic empire. Now we come to the next resurrection, the fifth one, which was under Napoleon, who became the Emperor of France. Napoleon was crowned by the Pope in 1804. And the story goes that, you know, when the Pope was old and doddery and couldn't kind of lift the crown, and he was going like this, and Napoleon got impatient and took the crown, put it on his own head. However, a lot of people think he intended to do that anyway, because he was showing that the state was over the church and not the other way around. And this was a revolutionary concept because the Pope was considered the senior royal in the whole of Europe. You know, he was over all the kings. But now Napoleon was trying to establish something a little bit different. Well, of course, Napoleon's dream of universal domination failed. The 200th anniversary of one of his biggest setbacks was just a few weeks ago, the Battle of Trafalgar, where the British fleet sank a combined French and Spanish fleet. The British fleet was smaller, but they won against the French and the Spanish. And that secured Britain's maritime supremacy, which really was the beginning of the era in which we live today. And this is kind of an insert here, because the British Empire and the United States are not one of the seven revivals of the Roman Empire. The characteristics of the British Empire and the United States were very, very different, because the British Empire and the United States have been built on individualism and liberty, not perfectly by any means. But the Roman system is built on tyranny. Napoleon was a tyrant. You know, so were the other leaders of the Roman Empire. So was Rome itself, varying degrees of tyranny. But, you know, and also the British and the Americans have given religious freedom, especially to the Jews and to those that follow the commandments of God. So I just want to insert here, so you get a picture of the time frame here, because we're looking at history. Genesis 48 predicted, it prophesied, that one of the sons of Jacob, Joseph, his children would receive tremendous blessings. The two children were called Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim, who was the second born, was to become a great company of nations, whereas Manasseh was to be a single nation. He, Manasseh, also shall become a people. He also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. If you look at this, Genesis 49 adds these words. It does not mention Ephraim and Manasseh. It mentions Joseph, who was the common ancestor of Ephraim and Manasseh. I'll show you a map in a moment. In fact, let me show you the map first, and then I'll go back to this. But here's the map, okay? This is what was developing, what was beginning around the time of the Napoleonic Wars. America had broken away from Britain. America was gradually to become the greatest single nation, Manasseh, but the British were the greatest multitude of nations. The British Empire was 13.9 million square miles. The United States is, I think, 3.9 million square miles. So the British Empire was vast. Everything colored red there is the British Empire. The blue bit, for the benefit of those of you who went to public school, is the United States of America. Okay? Just go back here again. You see, it's interesting. This is why it's hard for us to understand where we are prophetically. Because, you know, most churches do not understand the identity of Israel. The Jews in the Middle East are only one of the tribes of Israel. There were 12 tribes of Israel. In fact, the Jews are two, actually. They're Judah and Benjamin. But the other 10 tribes were lost. And one of those tribes, Joseph, was to become, you know, the greatest power in the world, a multitude of nations, or a commonwealth of nations. And then Manasseh was to become the greatest single nation. So, you know, what happened to them? And most churches don't want to get into this. And so this understanding of prophecy is lost. But even amongst those who do understand that the United States and Britain are descended from Manasseh and also from Ephraim, often people overlook this particular passage in Genesis 49, which is about the last days. If you look at verse 1 of the chapter, it is a prophecy relating to the last days. So it's about the time prior to Christ's return. It says, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. Joseph has been very productive. The British and the Americans have developed economies around the world at an incredible rate. You know, I lived in Africa for many years, and there was a time where the country we lived just hated the United States and Britain, and it was a poverty-stricken backwater where nothing worked and people starved. Eventually, a government came to power that said, we need help from the United States and Britain. They asked us for help, and now the country's prospering. You know, and this has been our record of economic development, creating prosperity wherever we go. Again, not perfectly. Nobody's saying we've been perfect at all. But Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall, just like a well, you know, gives water. So it's very productive around there, very green. Notice the next part, though. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. So here is a prophecy, again, about the end time, and about Joseph's military role. Now, Joseph, remember, is the British and the Americans. Now, before World War II, Britain was the dominant power. And if you look back at the last 200 years, the country that has fought the most wars has been Great Britain. And many of those wars, not all of them, but many of them, have been against tyrants who wanted to take over the world. And so, and then of course the United States took over that role largely after World War II. And this has been our history. In the 1800s, for example, the British single-handedly tried to stamp out slavery around the world. In 1807, the slave trade was abolished. And the British Royal Navy was given the authority to stop any ships anywhere in the world and free the slaves. So Africa, over the course of the rest of the 19th century, in Africa, slavery was stamped out primarily by the Royal Navy. Now the British are no longer there. I saw a report by the United Nations last year. Slavery is back in every single African nation. All 53 countries. So that just gives you one example of, you know, this military role. But of course, the role has also been against dictators, some of the kings in Europe, for example, the Tsar, the Kaiser, and others. And then, of course, against Hitler and against, you know, some of the other despots, Mussolini and so on. And then against communism, and now, of course, against radical Islam. But this is a prophecy regarding the role of the U.S. and Britain. And, of course, one of those things, one of those military roles has been against these revivals of the Roman Empire. So it ties in with Daniel chapter 7. So let's move on and get back to Daniel chapter 7, or rather Revelation 17 verse 10 at this particular point. We've seen five resurrections, five revivals of the Roman Empire. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Here's the next revival of the Roman Empire, the First World War, World War I. The Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, who tried to create a German empire, which would take over. This is the First World War, and then we get to the Second World War, Hitler's Third Reich. The Kaiser was the Second Reich. The Kaisers were the Second Reich. The First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. The Second Reich was the Kaisers from 1870 to 1918. The Third Reich was Hitler from 1933 to 1945. This is the Third Reich. The Second Reich and the Third Reich really were the same attempt at Germanic domination of the world. The Germans were struggling against the Anglo-Saxon powers, primarily the British Empire and then later on the United States. Of course, the Allies won against the Axis powers. But the Germans were trying to conquer the world. And many historians look upon this as one continual struggle, about 30 years. We weren't fighting all the time. After 1918, you had peace for 21 years. Then there was World War II. But they were a part of the same revival of the Roman Empire. And during that time, this understanding of these different revivals of the Roman Empire came into the church. And, the prophecy says five have fallen, one is. So the one that is this one we're talking about here. Then we come to the last one, Revelation 17:12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour, for a short time, as kings with the beast. So here there's to be another revival of the Roman Empire. This is the revival in embryonic form, the European Union, which has 25 nations in it. It is already the world's biggest single market and the world's biggest trading power. It is not the world's biggest military power. The United States is still the world's biggest military power. But this is the final revival of the Roman Empire in embryonic form. 10 of these nations are going to come together. 10 of these nations are going to come together. As it says here in Revelation 17, verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So again, this leads us right into the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, when you look at the Bible, there's no denying the fact that the United States will not be the dominant power until the very end of this age of man's rule, because this final revival of the beast power is going to come up, and it's going to be again an aggressive, despotic, and tyrannical system. It won't last very long. The EU itself is not the beast power, because the EU is 25 nations. It's also democratic. It's very similar to us. But the final revival of the Roman Empire is going to come out of that system. Now, Daniel 7, verse 27 adds these words here, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So, again, this takes us right up until the coming of the kingdom of God. Now, I've got 3 minutes left. I want to quickly show you something else, okay? Because I want to show you there's something else, another theme running through history, which ties in with our world today. And I only decided to add this yesterday. But, Mr. Moranville talked about Islam, and Mr. McNeely was in the Middle East with his presentation too. So I want to just add this bit here, because there's another theme that runs through history. There is that one theme of the revivals of the Roman Empire and the Roman system, the beast power system. But there's also been throughout history occasional clashes between two civilizations, Islam and Christianity. And it seems as if we are heading into another clash between the Islamic world and the post-Christian world. I don't want to say Christian world, because most of Europe is very secular today. But you know, the religion of Islam began in the 600s. Muhammad started receiving his revelations in 610. He died in 632. Before the year 700, his religion spread from Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina, and it spread throughout all that green area. That's how fast Islam spread in the 7th century. And by 732, 100 years after Muhammad's death, Muslim forces were at the gates of Paris in France. They were defeated by the forces of Charles Martel on French soil. It's kind of ironic that France had a lot of violence last month with Muslims, 3 weeks in a row of rioting by Muslim youth. And, you know, one commentator said it's the first time in 1,300 years that France had had a major problem with violence from Muslims. But, you know, it goes back 1,300 plus years. Now, let's have a look further. In the late 1000s, 1100s, 1200s, you had the Crusades, which I don't have a map for. I put this together yesterday. The Crusades were the Pope called the nations of Europe together to go and fight the Muslims because the Muslims were stopping Christians from seeing the holy places. The Crusades lasted 200 years. It was a major clash between Islam and the forces of the Christian world. And even today, the word crusade is highly emotional to Muslims. When President Bush used the word crusade after September the 11th, he said, well, you know, we're going to go on a crusade against radical Islam. It was the worst thing he could have said. And he's never used that word again because of the reaction to that word. But realize something else. When the Christians went into the Holy Land in 1095 and the 1100s, they captured most of the Holy Land, including Jerusalem, and they set up a Christian kingdom in the Holy Land. And the Muslims just hated the presence of Christian forces in what had been Islamic territory. And today they equate the nation of Israel with that kingdom of Jerusalem. And there is a hatred of Israel partly because of this. In the mindset of the Muslims, when a country becomes Muslim, then it must stay that way forever. It cannot go the other way. So, for example, Muslims also want Spain back because Spain was ruled by Muslims for about 800 years. So they feel that Spain also belongs to them, not just Israel. And then later on, after the Crusades, you had the growth of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, everything colored purple there. They got right into the heart of Europe. They tried to take the city of Vienna twice. So another major clash, you see, between Islam and Christianity. This is the decline of the Ottoman Empire. Gradually, each country broke away from the Ottoman Empire. Then, of course, again, you had the rise of the United States and Britain, the British Empire. Britain ended up ruling these countries in the Middle East. Everything colored red there was ruled by Britain right up until World War II. And pretty much kept under control. Not perfectly, but it was kept pretty much under control right up until World War II. You see, the British ruled Iraq at that time as well. But then after World War II, all these countries broke away and they got their independence. And the map of the Middle East became much more complicated. And of course, the most significant change was the Jewish state of Israel came into existence in May 1948. And that has been the biggest source of contention in the Middle East since then. But I want to show you something here very quickly, okay? You see, this is now the Islamic conference. These are the nations that belong to the Islamic conference. After World War II, I was born a few years after World War II. At that time, the world was still pretty much dominated by the British and the Americans. This was the map of the world after World War II. Okay? But notice how different the map is now. Now, you see in Africa, you've got the red bit, Egypt and Sudan. That was British. To the west of that, it was all French. The French basically dominated North Africa. The Italians were there a little bit, but mostly the French. And gradually after World War II, the French lost control. The British were driven out of the Middle East. And so today you've had all these other countries that have, you know, gotten their independence and have significant Muslim populations. So one of the great trends of the past 50 years has been this increased Islamic presence and power in the world. So they've gone from 1950, where only two or three Islamic countries were independent, to today, where there are 22 Arab countries, there are 57 Muslim nations. Not all of them are completely Muslim, but some of them are. So they become a very powerful bloc. And in this decade in which we live, a seismic shift is taking place. Because in this decade, the numbers of Muslims in the world will outnumber the number of people claiming to be Christian. So that's a very significant shift. They have a much higher birth rate than what we've got. And of course, there are many people in the Islamic world, maybe not all of them, but many, that feel that Islam, you know, must conquer the whole world and that everybody must become a Muslim. In fact, Muhammad's last words were, and I'm quoting from memory here, they're in a book called The History of the Arab Peoples, written by a Muslim. Muhammad's last words were that his followers should not rest until everybody in the world praises Allah. So in other words, you know, kill everybody basically until they all become Muslims. It's frightening. It really is. But this is what we're up against. Now realize too, we've heard references to the kings of the north and the king of the south. Here's the king of the south. Maybe not all of those countries, but you know, many of those countries, Islamic nations, out of them is going to come some leader who will push against the king of the north. There's the king of the north coming together now. You see how much the world has changed in our lifetime, in my lifetime? All of this has taken place in my lifetime, and, you know, I'm not very old. So, you see that. Anyway, that is the way it is. And the Bible basically gives us this overview of history. You know, over the last 2,600 years, the beast power system, the Roman system, which has continued down until our day in the church and with these revivals of the Roman Empire, this brief period of time where the British and American people reached their ascendancy, and then we see the rise of Islam, the King of the South too. So it all fits together, you see, and it's building up to the end time events, including the final battle that we heard about. It's all building up to that. But then, of course, is the second coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. So ultimately, it is good news. It is the gospel of the coming kingdom. That's where the emphasis is on Christ's return. But these events have to take place first before Jesus Christ returns to this earth. I'm out of time, so I'll finish there.